more on this. We're joined live now by author and historian Gerald Horne. Thanks for joining us here on RT today. Do you think that if the Syrian government was caught with sarin gas, that the reaction from the international community would have been as muted?
If the Syrian government had been caught with sarin gas, we would have heard war whoops from Washington, London, and Paris. But of course, this report that you've just reported on should not come as a surprise to any who've been paying attention. We know that the internationally respected civil servant Carla Del Ponte had basically made a similar discovery and revelation on behalf of the United Nations just weeks ago, which then was refuted by the White House. We also know that in recent days, Senator John McCain of Arizona, who ran for the U.S. presidency some 6 or 7 years ago, entered Syria illegally, and news reports indicate that he consulted with the White House before entering Syria. This is a very dangerous turn of events. It's clear that there are those in Washington who would like to intervene in Syria on behalf of the rebels, which is quite curious since, as your report indicates, al-Nusra Front, which has been designated as a terrorist organization by Washington, is at the tip of the spear in the opposition against President al-Assad.
Doesn't this incident then cross President Obama's red line in terms of those intending to use chemical weapons?
Well, one would think so, but of course we know that the United States, along with its NATO partners, Britain and France, are quite close to the main backers of the rebels. I'm speaking of Saudi Arabia and Qatar. We know, for example, according to the Financial Times, that Mr. Sarkozy, the former president of France, is in very close financial relationships with the Qataris. We know from past and recent history that the Saudis are heavily invested in the City of London, that there have been a number of corrupt arms deals between the British arms industry and the Saudis. We also know that the eminent Saudi prince, Bandar, was so close to the Bush family, the former president of the United States, that he was referred to as Bandar Bush, and in fact had painted his private planes the same colors as his favorite football team, the Dallas Cowboys. Dallas happens to be the home of former U.S. President George W. Bush.
Okay. Let me just take you back to the situation now. The EU arms embargo against Syria is just hours away from being lifted. How keen are some European states from looking to arm the rebels?
Well, obviously, they're very keen. I think that their financial relationships are pushing them towards arming the rebels, that is to say, the European debt crisis and the Europeans being bailed out by the Gulf Arabs is obviously helping to shape their calculations. Sadly, that is the unfortunate state of affairs.
Now, Russian shipments of S-300 anti-aircraft missiles have arrived in Syria. I mean, if Europe wanted to send arms, then why has Moscow received such a negative response to what it's done?
It's quite curious because obviously what Moscow is doing is sending anti-aircraft weaponry to Damascus. The rebels do not have aircraft, so they should not be challenged by these arms or weapons, anti-aircraft deliveries. It's only aggressor states like Israel, for example, which bombed Syria just weeks ago, that should be threatened. It's only the United States, which is talking about a so-called no-fly zone, which should be threatened by this kind of delivery. In order to effectuate a no-fly zone, obviously, Washington would have to destroy on the ground a good deal of the Syrian Air Force. So this cry of these opponents of these arms deliveries is quite insubstantiated and quite curious.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. Gerald Horne, author and historian, thanks for joining us here today on RT.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Radio Regent. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, and joining me on the line is Dr. Gerald Horne. Are you there?
Yes, sir.
All right. Do you have any problems hearing me?
Oh, no. It's better than usual.
Beautiful. Okay. Well, Gerald Horne is the John and Rebecca Morris Professor at the University of Houston in Houston, Texas. And we have a number of issues, burning issues, to talk about today. I guess the first issue is the president of China going to Trinidad and Tobago. And I remember when I was growing up, before I really met a Trinidadian, I should say the first Trinidadian I ever met, who I never met, was Eugene Chin, I think. He went to work. He was a overseas Chinese, but he's born in San Fernando, Trinidad. But he went to work with the Sun Yat-sen government in the 1920s. Could you talk about the visit of the president of China to TNT? And also, could you reflect on Eugene Chin?
Well, I'm happy you mentioned Eugene Chin, who worked with the Republican Chinese government in league with Sun Yat-sen. If I'm not mistaken, Eugene Chin also had, it was either a daughter, there was this Chinese Trinidadian dancer who was very close to Langston Hughes, the black American writer and poet. Do you know the name I'm speaking of?
I know.
I think her name was Sylvia Chin, if I'm not mistaken.
That's Malik's godmother's name, Sylvia Chin, but I should know that. But I remember something vaguely about that because, like I say, before I met a live Trinidadian, I know when we were in California, we always talked, J.A. Rogers talked about that in one of his books about Eugene Chin. You know, he had all of this obscure, which wasn't really obscure information, but a lot of people, you know, never took, a lot of, well, the bourgeoisie people never took, J.A. Rogers that seriously, you know.
Mm. Well, it also bespeaks the fact that there is a huge Chinese origin population in the Caribbean, particularly in Trinidad. The U.S.-based writer Wally Looklai, in fact, has written about that, and there's a new book out on the Chinese population in Cuba. It's interesting, when there was a crackdown on the African slave trade in the mid-19th centuries, basically spearheaded by London, you saw that the plantation owners then moved to import Chinese labor, so-called coolie labor, as it was called. And no, I should also add, it was also labor from India as well, which helps to account for the substantial population of South Asian descent in Trinidad and Tobago and Guyana in particular. There's a new book out, in fact, on the Chinese population of Cuba. And I recall that it was not so long ago that on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, there were numerous Chinese-Cuban restaurants that festooned that area, although I guess high rents have driven them out. But in any case, this visit to China, this visit to Trinidad and Tobago, President Xi Jinping, is very significant. We know that Trinidad and Tobago is energy rich. We know that China has a ravenous appetite for energy, for oil and natural gas. So this should make for a bountiful relationship between Trinidad and Tobago and China. We also know that the U.S. Vice President Joseph Biden was in the vicinity just days preceding the visit of President Xi, and I doubt if that was coincidence because, as is well known, Washington is getting quite hysterical about the rise of China, a hysteria that I'm afraid has trickled down to a good deal of the population in North America, as we've talked about more than once on this program. And we also know that President Xi Jinping, in addition to visiting Trinidad and Tobago, also plans to visit Mexico. And by next weekend, he'll be in sunny Southern California, your old stomping grounds, meeting for 2 days with U.S. President Barack Obama. And this would be a very important gathering because, as noted, there's a lot of hysteria about China, a lot of attacks on China with regard to so-called cyber espionage and cyber warfare, that is to say, Chinese hackers allegedly tapping into U.S. computers, networks, and stealing secrets of various sorts. There was a lot of hysteria that greeted the fact that a Chinese company based in Shanghai, if I'm not mistaken, just bought Smithfield's, which is a major pork producer. As you know, pork is a staple of the diet of many Chinese, and now they're going to be controlling world pork supplies through buying Smithfield's of North Carolina, Virginia. So this is the backdrop to this trailblazing visit by President Xi Jinping to the Americas.
Let me say that I spent about 8 months in Los Angeles, and I know that every other day there were front page stories or second page stories on China. I would say 75% of them were very, very negative, extremely negative. I guess
this is quite a turnabout. We know that after the visit of President Richard M. Nixon to Beijing some four decades ago in the early 1970s, there was a warming of relations between Beijing and Washington, and that warming was reflected in the population as a whole. As you know, China was very popular amongst many black Americans. There's an article by the historians Robin Kelly and Betty Esch in the journal Souls entitled Black Like Mao, which basically details that the warm relationship between black Americans and China. The young scholar at the University of Southern California by the name of Taj Robeson Frazier is in the process of publishing a book with Duke University Press entitled The East is Black, which goes into detail in that warm relationship between China and the United States, a relationship that in some ways was encapsulated by the time spent in China by the black American exile Robert F. Williams, the black American exile Shirley Graham Du Bois, and many others. And so it's very interesting and intriguing that now that China is on the verge of becoming the leading power in the world, that relationship suddenly has cooled. Coincidentally enough, as the relationship between Washington and Beijing has cooled, the relationship between black America and Beijing is cool. Surprise, surprise.
Well, let me ask you one question about China, then we wanted to move on to the AU African Standby Force. But did you know Vicky Garvin personally? Because she spent a lot of time in China, I believe.
Well, yeah. I remember right before she died, I visited her in her apartment in Queens, New York. I think it was Rochdale Village, if not mistaken. I was there to interview her. Maybe it was for my book on Shirley Graham Du Bois. I can't recall specifically. But I do recall spending time talking with her about China. Of course, she had lived in Ghana, West Africa, before going to live in China. And before that, she lived in New York and was part of the progressive forces, the left-wing forces in New York, a woman who lived a substantial life.
Yep, and she also knew Malcolm X when he was Malcolm Little, when he was a jitterbug. Yeah, but I have a long interview with Vicky Garvin, which I have to get transcribed and put out there because it's she was a fascinating human being. Let me just leave it at that. But the Africa Standby Force came out of the AU, which was celebrated 50 years of existence, although I guess it was the OAU before. But is the African Standby Force similar to what Kwame Nkrumah was trying to put together in 1963, or what he called for in 1963 when the OAU was created in Addis Ababa?
Well, in a sense, yes. But, of course, times have changed. It's just like I think we're going to talk about, and I guess I'll anticipate it by mentioning it now, the 8th Pan-African Congress, which is scheduled for South Africa in a few months. Now, obviously, it's one thing to talk about a Pan-African movement when most of Africa is colonized. It's another thing to talk about, say, a Pan-African Congress when most of Africa is independent and sovereign and has an organization based in Addis Ababa, the African Union, which in many ways encapsulates the idea that the fathers of Pan-Africanism wanted to establish. And so likewise, when we talk about this African Standby Force in 2013, it's different from talking about it in the 1960s when there were wars of national liberation to be fought. Now this African Standby Force would become involved, for example, in the Central African Republic, which, as you know, in recent months has gone through a spate of unrest that was marked, I'm afraid, by a sharp clash between France and South Africa, which are two of the leading forces on the continent. This African Standby Force, for example, could become involved in Somalia. There's a very interesting and lengthy piece in today's Financial Times on Mogadishu. And the only complaint I would have, well, not the only complaint, but a complaint I would have about this article is that in terms of talking about the decline of Somalia and the rise of suicide bombings and all the rest, is that it doesn't go into detail in terms of how President Siad Barre of Somalia in the 1970s, who theretofore had tried to style his country as a kind of socialist-oriented nation. I recall being in Ghana in 1973 and watching movies about Somalia from that time and hearing speeches about from Siad Barre, and it was remarkable, the socialist rhetoric that was coming. But what happens is that Somalia was manipulated against Ethiopia, and basically it claimed that Ethiopia had control of Somali territory, and so it went down that irredentist nationalist route and tried to reclaim this territory from Ethiopia through force of arms, which plunged both nations into a tailspin. It took Ethiopia a while to recover, but I think it's fair to say that it has recovered, at least compared to Somalia. Whereas Somalia, according to this article and according to many other sources, it remains a rather dangerous place to visit. It remains a place where women in particular are being subject to various kinds of persecution. Now, the African Standby Force, for example, could play a role in a nation like Somalia. Right now, of course, there are United Nations and African Union forces there. An African Standby Force, for example, could play a role in Eastern Congo, which, as you know, has been subjected to turmoil of various sorts for years now. An African Standby Force could have become involved in Cote d'Ivoire a couple of years ago when you had the standoff between two presidential contenders. An African Standby Force could have played a role in Mali, that is to say, after the rise of conservative religious radicals there helped to spark an intervention by the French. So I don't think that this African Standby Force will be sitting around twiddling its thumbs. I think it has a long agenda ahead of it. And let us hope that it is able to effectuate the promise that it now seems to embody.
You're listening to Radio Regent. My name is Norman Richmond. I'm on the line with Dr. Gerald Horn. And I wanted to give you an update on the mayor of Toronto, Rob Ford. And one of his counselors, Jane Robinson, was forced to talk about Ford's crack cocaine scandal at a groundbreaking ceremony of a community garden, and columns continue to come out calling for Mr. Ford, Mayor Ford, to step down and do a Richard Nixon. But Mr. Ford and his brother are basically claiming that they're innocent. They have a radio show, which I listened to last week. Rob Ford is the hardliner, and Doug Ford is the sort of the peacemaker. It's rather comical. There was a story in a Now magazine how Rob Ford's brother, they received a call from a black woman, and the Ford referred to her. She basically asked a question, and Ford referred to her Doug Ford said that she was a racist. And, you know, Now magazine, which is an alternative publication in Toronto, jumped on him about that. So it's still simmering, the Rob Ford issue.
Well, for listeners who may not be familiar, they should know that apparently there is footage that purports to show the mayor of Toronto, Rob Ford, smoking crack. My understanding is that the people who held this tape wanted $200,000 for it,
and they,
that the $200,000 has been raised, but correct. Now they can't find the people with the tape. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding, too. So maybe there's some, maybe they are disappeared, have been disappeared, like people are disappeared in many countries.
Now, is it your understanding that the people who were making the tape were of Somali origin?
You could make that inference. The people that are in the photograph with him are of Somali origin, so we could conclude or we could reduce, say that that's the assumption, right? The brother who is next to Ford in the video was murdered. And
when?
Beg your pardon? In March.
When was he murdered?
In March. March. March of... March of this year or last year, but this year.
Are there any suspects?
Any suspects? Not that I know of. Not that I know of. Not that I know of. He is, the story is that his brother, Doug, was selling hashish in the 80s, and they have basically said that Doug Ford and the whole family supposedly been involved in, they're saying that the whole family was involved in drug trafficking. In particular, Doug was supposed to be the hash man. That's been publicized highly. And the Globe and Mail has got into it, and people are saying that the Globe and Mail knew this all along, but the Fords made a deal with the police, pardon me, the Fords made a deal with the police many years ago that they would let them do what they were doing because of the corruption between inside the police department and also the corruption on the political front. So that's, people have basically said that's in the mix too.
So where is this story heading?
I think I tend to agree with you. I think the story is heading that I think Ford is going to be out, and because I think there's a split within the ruling class, and they want someone, I guess, to represent Toronto with a little bit that's a little bit smoother. You know, an Olivia Chow, for example. There is a problem with Ford. He's not too good for the optics of so-called. Well, not a so-called, but a city like Toronto, which is probably the most multicultural city on the planet Earth, I would think. I don't think you can have someone with a...
Well,
beg your pardon?
No, I'm just saying, we shall see.
And let's move to the Pan-African Congress in South Africa. The last Pan-African Congress I attended was in Kampala, Uganda. And it was...
And what year was that?
1994. That was the same year that the Rwanda president was killed. Abdul Rahman Mohamed Babu announced that. And there were people from that Pan-Africa that were there from Adid, from Somali was there, Kwame Nkrumah's daughter, Walter Rodney's wife. Oh, people, Lombe Brath was there. People there from all over the world. It was quite an affair. Abdul Al-Kalimat, Kwame Ture, just before he got sick. Yeah, it got kind of heated too.
Over what issue?
Over the issue of who was going to, over the issue of, the North American, the New York people, let me be very bluntly, the New York people wanted to represent the whole North America. I argued that North America was Canada, New Mexico, not Mexico, but Mexico and the United States. And I think it was Leonard Jeffries was basically said there was not enough black people in Mexico to make a difference, and Canada was kind of irrelevant. So basically, some forces out of New York basically wanted to control the agenda of North America, and that was it got kind of out of hand.
Was their attempt not necessarily geographical, but ideological? That is to say, their attempt to control the agenda of North America, was it because there was an apparent ideological conflict between those in the United States and those in Canada, for example?
Not necessarily, no, because you had the, I would say the anti-imperialist force, the anti-imperialist forces were basically united. And the anti-imperialist forces, I would say, were some of the Muslims were anti-imperialist. I must say, a lot of the Rastas, there were some Rastas from Uganda who didn't want the Indians to be included in the mix. The Indians or the Arabs, they took the ultra-black position. I think it was just. It was the North American contingency was an anti-imperialist, but of course there was, you know, differences between the Marxists, the revolutionary nationalists, and the New York forces wanted to control. And the New York forces had some Marxists, some Muslims, and so it wasn't that way out in terms of ideology.
Well, in any case, as I noted, the 8th Pan-African Congress will be meeting in South Africa. I looked at the agenda. They don't seem at this point to be anticipating a sizable delegation coming there. It'll be taking place in January. It'll be taking place at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. And as noted, there's a difference between a Pan-African movement during a time when Europe is mostly colonized. As a matter of fact, I would say that in terms of the Pan-African movement as representing these congresses, they seem to be of more relevance, quite frankly, to the North Americans, who, particularly in Canada and the United States, where you have Africans who don't have sovereignty. And as a result of not having sovereignty, this Pan-African movement becomes an important lever for these Africans in North America to wield.
I would agree.
Whereas the Africans on the continent and the Caribbean, they have sovereignty. And therefore, it would seem to me that the Pan-African movement may not be as relevant to them. I mean, I'm not sure what your opinion is on that.
Oh, I agree with that completely. I have a good friend of mine named T.N. Providence. We always argue about that. I say that, you know, at least he's from St. Vincent and the Grenadines. I say, yeah, at least you guys have a vote. Now, they might not take your vote, but Negroes in America, we don't even, or Negroes in America, I should say we, but Africans in the Canada and the United States don't even have a vote. It's like American blacks have to go whatever President Obama says, and black people in Canada have to go with whatever Prime Minister Stephen Harper says. Like we don't have an independent position.
So it'll be very interesting to see who turns up in Johannesburg in a few months.
And I wanted to talk about the Indian leadership in Tokyo. Zimbabwe, and the new role of Japan.
Well, as I noted last week, because the North Atlantic countries are so hysterical about China, their new strategy is basically to build up Japan as a counterweight against China. But for those of us who have memories of the period from 1941 to 1945, we can attest that's a very dangerous and ominous strategy, and it's a strategy that these North Atlantic leaders may live to regret. They've acquiesced to the weakening of the yen, the Japanese currency, which has given a shot in the arm to the Japanese economy, which is heavily dependent upon exports. Toyotas and Nissans, for example, which price is heavily dependent in the North American and European market on being based upon a weak yen. And also, as part of Japan's new muscular role, they've been reaching out very strongly worldwide. As noted, the Indian leadership, Prime Minister Tsang, is in Tokyo this week. And that whole alliance, that entire alliance between Tokyo and New Delhi, might wind up being the most important bilateral relationship of the 21st century. President Mugabe of Zimbabwe is in Tokyo this week. In Yokohama. There is a major gathering in Yokohama this week on African development. As we noted last week, for those brothers and sisters who don't like China's role in Africa, well, let's see what they have to say about Japan's role in Africa, because it's already substantial and it's about to become even more substantial.
Well, let me ask you the last question. Black Music Month, does it have anybody been talking about it? I see that in Philadelphia they're having a show on one of the black radio stations where Kenny Gamble, Lukman, who's the founder of Philadelphia International and the co-founder of the Black Music Association, and Sonia Sanchez and other people are going to begin commemorating Black Music Month. But have you heard anything about it?
Not specifically, although I will seize this opportunity to note the passing of the great pianist Mulgrew Miller, who died just in this past week at the age of 57. He had a stroke and was not able to recover. You can hear him on countless albums. And here's a brother who basically started playing the piano as a youth in Mississippi and then, of course, wound up playing all over the world, was a professor of jazz studies at William Patterson College in New Jersey at the point of his passing away. And it's a significant loss to the world of music.
I saw him with Betty Carter at a place called Basin Street in Toronto. And also Marvin Jr., the lead singer of the Dales, I should say Teddy Pendergrass's, not his biological father, but his musical father. He passed away as well.
Yeah, and Clarence Burke of the
Five Stair Steps. Ooh, child, yeah, ooh, child.
Well, you know, whenever I think of the Five Stair Steps, I think of public relations. And what's the connection, you ask? Well, think of this. The Five Stair Steps and the group then known as the Jackson Five, basically, they emerge at a similar period in history, one from Chicago and one from Gary, Indiana. And I would say that they're similarly talented. But for various reasons, the Jacksons take off into the stratosphere, and the Five Stair Steps do not.
They were obscured.
And there is a lesson there somewhere, and I would say part of the lesson is public relations. That is to say, the ability to have an astute management team, the ability to get in the newspapers, the ability to get your voice heard.
I concur. I really concur, because like Clarence Burke was, he could hold his own with anybody. I mean, they had talent. They had it was a male and female group, and they could write, produce, and they had a stunning stage show. And that Ooh Child was, that was a classic song. That's, that was everybody's favorite song, 1972, I believe.
And then some of the aphorisms, world of fantasy,
yep,
danger, she's a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's no accident that their work is still being sampled in 2013.
Yeah, that was Curtis Mayfield put them on the map. All right, Mr. Horn, next week.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, we have been speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, and we're going to be getting ready to speak with Ewart Walters very, very shortly.